It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. We're fat, we're sick, and it's your fault. That was the essence of a lawsuit against McDonald's by two teenagers. McD's response was, our food is okay. Our guest, filmmaker Morgan Spurlock, set out to see who was right. He ate three meals a day for a month at the Arches. His film is Super Size Me. The Sterns answer the pressing question, does sublime Jewish deli travel, like to San Diego? It's chic, it's tasty, it's pricey, it's Pinot Noir, but Josh Wesson has bargains. John Willoughby talks lamb on the cheap, and novelist Eleanor Lipman muses about how food builds great literary character. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Sample a taco paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davey, Tommy, Dora. Mandrake. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta Fazula Cholula. Oh, do have a bagel, bagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Now, don't make me nag ya, mag ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata lata. Nibble a kibble, Sybil. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Busta, Cher, Chops, Thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, cake, pie, son. Juice, root, tart, bart. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Haddie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can-can like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore. Tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuet, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. The Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
The music's hot, so the lock stock's hot, and the Halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the coffee bowl. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shuffle of jibbuffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the carpet ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't like the sardine can. Tuna trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the carpet ball. At the codfish ball. At the codfish ball. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk with the man who ate three meals a day for a month at McDonald's. Our guest is filmmaker Morgan Spurlock. His movie is Super Size Me. Wine maverick Josh Wesson is hunting down that rare breed, good but cheap, Pinot Noir. Still in the bargain mode, Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby talks lamb, the kindest cuts. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hi, guys.
Hey, Len.
Hi, Len.
Guys, do you think great Jewish deli can exist outside of New York City?
Without any doubt, the answer is yes. Shapiro's in Indianapolis, Manny's Cafeteria in Chicago, and DZ Aiken's in San Diego are all examples of absolutely top-notch kosher-style delis that serve some of the best Jewish food you can get anywhere, including the Lower East Side of New York City.
Hmm.
You may be skeptical, but here's the test to take. Order some rye bread. In fact, Jane and I have been very concerned lately. There is a rye bread crisis in New York City. When you go to Katz's Deli downtown, the Carnegie Midtown, you get excellent pastrami, corned beef, brisket. The bread that they put it on is not what it ought to be. You want that rye bread with the real good sour crust, the caraway seeds in it, the real kind of chewy, muscular rye bread that will sustain, you know, a half-pound sandwich. We haven't gotten that lately in New York. We did get it at DZ Aiken's in San Diego.
Now, this is San Diego. I mean, what does San Diego know about this kind of deli?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, Lynn. I mean, you know, don't forget, I grew up in New York City, and I'm a Jew, so therefore I'm an expert on, you know, on all things, on everything.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, where there's sun, there should be no deli, you know, and San Diego being, you know, this wonderful, you know, beachy, surfy area.
Right, exactly.
It's antithetical. I mean, it's just like, how can you eat a half pound of pastrami and then go sit in the sun? I mean, you would just die. But in fact, that's not true. And I do have to say that probably the best homemade blintzes, which is one of my top 10 all-time favorite things, and matzo brei, which nobody makes very palatable matzo brei except Michael at home, had the best versions of those two things at DZ Aiken's that I have had in years.
You know, I think you ought to explain what matzo brei is.
Well, oftentimes you see matzo brei described as a matzah omelet, meaning, you know, matzahs, the unleavened crackers, are
right,
broken up and put into eggs. To me, that's going in the entirely wrong direction, meaning when you describe it as an omelet, there's too much egg to matzah. To me, it is matzah kind of gently coated in egg so that it has a consistency that is vaguely related to French toast. It's eggy matzah that is fried in massive amounts of butter. And the butter is absorbed into the matzah. And you serve it with either sour cream or applesauce or possibly both. And it's really one of the great kind of Jewish soul food breakfasts lunches, dinners, or midnight snacks.
Okay, well, now tell me about this deli. What is it like?
It's huge.
It's an entire shopping center.
Yeah.
It's multiple rooms. There's an entire soda fountain in one part of it. It goes against all rules of what you would expect a cozy Jewish deli to be like. There are tables, there are booths, there is a long counter, there's a place to get ice cream floats, there's an entire menu of ice cream. There are eight kinds of homemade soup every single day. It's kind of inexplicable how huge it is, and yet it seems to be thriving.
And what really annoys me is that Michael's mother and father retired to San Diego 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and we just found this place 2 weeks ago. I mean, we could have been eating blintzes and matzo brei for 20 years, but no, we were eating fish tacos.
Well, thank you, guys. Okay, I'm going to have to ponder this.
Believe us. It's true.
It's true. It's all true.
Okay, bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, they join us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, sign up for Weeknight Kitchen. It's our weekly newsletter, and it's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique and shopping tips, and best of all, it's free. So sign up on that center for all good stuff. SplendidTable.org. Joshua Wesson is my favorite maverick. He's a wine expert who follows his own drummer. He believes good wine can be had for little money, and he's always coming up with new ideas for what to try. Josh, it's good to have you back.
Hi.
What have you been thinking about lately?
Well, you know, I'm a Pinot Noir fanatic. It's my favorite red grape. But I can't afford really expensive versions of it, so I've been rooting around, literally, for inexpensive Pinot Noir, and I've come up with a trio from at least one from an unlikely place that I think, you know, each offers an extraordinary and delicious take on this hard to grow and hard to make for not a lot of money wine.
Josh, why is Pinot Noir so expensive?
It's a very difficult grape to cultivate. It likes to grow in a fairly narrow range of temperatures and soils, and the best places for it are often places where a lot of other grapes struggle. Burgundy, of course, is the most famous place for Pinot Noir, and it's a relatively narrow and fairly short area, so there's not a lot of grape growing going on there anyway. And supply and demand and the fact that it's a finicky grape force the prices up to, you know, phenomenal levels. Entry-level Burgundy is about $15, and it quickly goes up to $30, $40, $50 a bottle from there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell us about your finds, then.
Well, there are three places that people look for Pinot Noir right now, and all of them are pretty expensive. Burgundy, I mentioned. Oregon is a hot zone for Pinot Noir, and New Zealand, recently hot. Mm-hmm. But none of those places offer great values because they all suffer from that Burgundy complex of tough to grow it, not a lot of space. But there are some places where you can get really good Pinot Noir. One of the off-the-radar screen locations is Italy, and they call it Pinot Nero there. And in the Veneto and in the northern parts of Italy, they can more or less mimic the climatic conditions that allow Pinot Noir to ripen. And I've come across one called La Vie, and it's fruity and light and lilting and elegant. It doesn't have the complexity of an expensive Pinot Noir, but then again, it's only $12.
For $12 and it's drinkable? It's interesting. Italy. Huh.
It's not one of those places that people think of Pinot Noir coming from. But if you just change the Noir to Nero and stop fiddling around, I think that you'll probably have a good time exploring Pinot Noirs from there.
Okay. Where else?
Well, California, of course. They've been growing Pinot Noir for a while. And since there's been a relative glut of grapes, it's a good time to wade into the ocean of grape juice in California and pick bottles that would ordinarily be more expensive. My favorite modestly priced Pinot Noir right now comes from Sonoma. It's made by a producer, Castle Rock. And for $14, here's a wine that can really play with the big boys. And you put it in a bag. And if you remember not to let the paper bag touch your lips and you pour it out, you can fool even the most sophisticated wine drinkers into thinking that it's a $20 or $25 bottle of wine.
Uh-huh. Oh, this is good. Okay, got another one.
Yeah, from Languedoc, a region south of Burgundy and not generally known for Pinot Noir. But in the cooler parts up in the hills, you can find Pinot Noir being successfully grown. And the Lertomme brothers, Jacques and Francois, make some of the best stuff down there. And their simple Pinot Noir is $11, but it tastes like a Bourgogne Rouge. It's remarkable, and I'm stunned. I take my chapeau off to them because I drink this wine a lot.
Well, should Pinot be a little on the cool side when you drink it?
Yes, it's a red grape that thinks it's a white grape. So it likes
an identity problem.
It does. So what do you do with a wine like that? You stick it in the fridge for a little while before you put it on the table. And this is a good suggestion for any red wine, but Pinot Noir in particular, because it's not a big tannic wine. It can take a little bit of chill. It focuses the fruit and makes it that much more delicious.
Sounds like great buys. Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Best Sellers Wine Shops. You can find his Pinot Noir picks on the website, splendidtable.org. I was leafing through Food Arts magazine recently, and I got inspired by an article on an Italian chef who specializes in canning. He literally serves canned food in his restaurants, but primo canned food. Well, it got me thinking about a perfect party plan for the person who is a hunter-gatherer rather than a cook. I mean, we can get good canned stuff here, and with it, you can create a bunch of little dishes. Now, for instance, tuna canned in olive oil. Turn it into Italian pate with some scallions, peppers, lemon, and white beans. Then you could do a spread with red pepper paste and anchovies, and you serve it on cucumbers. You could do a tapas take. Drizzle olive oil over spicy salami and top it with salted almonds and garlic. And then, you know, from the Middle East, think mezze. Shred carrots in yogurt and then add some onion and lemon. It's a natural dunk for celery. So for instant party, hunt and gather. Don't cook. Coming up, the mind behind Super Size Me and Lamb's Kindest Cuts. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/SuperTarget.
Uh-huh.
Filmmaker Morgan Spurlock came up with a great angle. You take one popular theory about why we Americans are so fat and you personalize it. Now, for Morgan, this meant deciding to eat three meals a day for a month at McDonald's. His film is Super Size Me. Morgan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a great idea. Where did you get it?
I mean, for me, the film was really inspired by the two girls who brought lawsuit against McDonald's. You know, there were the two girls in New York who were obese, had a lot of the diseases that were associated with being obese, and brought lawsuit against McDonald's and said, we're fat, we're sick, and it's your fault. And when I first heard this, you know, I'm not a litigious person, and I was pretty, you know, dumbfounded by it and taken aback. But the more I started to hear about the lawsuits, the more I started to hear about the marketing practices, how they target kids from such a young age, the more I heard about the manufacturing of the food, all the ingredients that go into making, you know, simple items, such, you know, like, you know, French fries or a chicken McNugget, and the nutritional value or the lack of nutritional value most of the food, I said, you know, there's definitely a basis for an argument here. And so I was sitting on my mother's couch, Thanksgiving 2002 in Beckley, West Virginia, the most fantastic day you could ever have an idea like this. And there was a spokesperson for McDonald's on the air talking about the lawsuits. And the spokesperson said, listen, you can't link our food to these girls being sick. You can't link our food to these girls being obese. Our food is healthy. It's nutritious. It's good for you. And so the light went off in the back of my head. And I said, well, if it's that good for me, then realistically, shouldn't I be able to eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 30 days straight with no side effects? You know, living the typical American lifestyle of overeating and under-exercising, shouldn't I be fine then? So that was kind of the impetus for the whole thing.
Okay, well, how was your health when you began? I mean, where were you?
I mean, when I came, I was a pretty healthy guy, you know. I ate what I want, you know, I would, you know, really not limit myself on a lot of things. But I mean, I wasn't a big overeater, and I exercised, you know, I was pretty active, and, you know, I was a pretty fit guy.
And you worked with doctors through this whole thing, right?
I did. I had three different doctors who were monitoring my progress, as well as a nutritionist and an exercise physiologist. You know, there was a cardiologist, a gastroenterologist, and hepatologist, and a general practitioner who were all three, you know, taking their own independent blood tests, doing their own independent analyses. And it was pretty astounding what happened.
Sounds like the entire Mayo Clinic was at your disposal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So what happened?
So about a week in, I started to get very depressed. I think it's just the highs and lows of the high-fat, high-sugar diet, you know, and the high caffeine, you know, it really started to set in. Mm-hmm. About 9 to 10 days in, I started to get cravings where I would eat, and then a couple hours later, I would just be hungry immediately after. About 2 weeks in, it started to impact my sex life, and, you know, basically impotence was setting in, which was incredible. By the third weekend, I was getting these incredible headaches that would envelop my just entire skull, and the only way to alleviate them would be by eating. So every time I would eat, the headaches would go away. And at this same stage, you know, I was, you know, feeling terrible. I was incredibly lethargic and just run down most of the time.
All right.
My weight had jumped up 24.5 pounds, and you know, my blood tests were so high at this point. My cholesterol had jumped up now about 60 points. My liver had filled with fat. You know, the fat content of my liver was so high that the doctors just couldn't believe it. And they were comparing my liver to pate, comparing it to, you know, Nicolas Cage in the movie Leaving Las Vegas, where he basically drank himself to death.
Uh-huh.
Because my liver was so sick. They were like, listen, you need to stop because we don't know what's going to happen to you. And it got really, really frightening.
Yeah, all right. But what were you eating exactly during all of this time?
I was eating everything. Come on. I was eating some of the best McDonald's money can buy. I ate, you know, I was eating everything on the menu. There were rules governing the whole process. I had to eat everything on the menu at least once. In fact, most of the time over the 30 days, I ate everything two or three times. I had to supersize it if they asked me. I could only eat things that were for sale over the counter at McDonald's, including water. You know, I mean, I didn't even have a Tic Tac for the whole 30 days. And I had to have at least three squares a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, snacks, desserts, everything I got from McDonald's.
But Morgan, as you started feeling so bad,
yeah,
there are salads there. You know, there's yogurt.
I was eating salad every 10 meals. But here's the thing you need to realize. McDonald's feeds almost 17 billion people a year, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the facts. Last year, they sold 150 million salads. That means less than 1% of everyone who goes to McDonald's eats a salad. You know, the thing is, we make poor choices, and my film is representative of the poor choices we make daily as Americans.
So now you've done this. Yeah. In your heart of hearts, do you really think that the fast food industry should be held responsible?
Well, I think the thing is, we can't keep pointing fingers. You know, we live in a society where we've been complacent for so long, and everybody wants to blame somebody else. And this is where we have to stop. You know, we can't keep blaming the corporations. Corporations can't keep blaming us. They can't keep blaming the parents. So what needs to happen is we need to meet somewhere in the middle. Do we need to eat more responsibly and take more personal responsibility for how we eat and live our lives? Yes, we absolutely do. And the corporations, you know what? McDonald's feeds 46 million people every single day. So do they have an obligation to their consumers to help educate them on how to eat their food wisely, on how to be more active, on how often they should eat their food if they're not active? Yes, they should. Absolutely, they have a responsibility. And that's the thing is people, far too many people are like, well, it's not their job to tell you that. You know what? When you feed 46 million people worldwide every day, more than the entire population of Spain, you have a huge responsibility. And, you know, we can't keep saying that these companies don't.
But we have seen some changes.
Yeah, we have seen some changes.
I mean, shortly after your film appeared, they stopped supersizing.
How great is that?
Well, more and more of the fast food companies are attempting to do healthier food. So do you think there's going to be improvement?
Well, I mean, you can hope so. But, I mean, for me, the most important thing, and where I think we really need to focus our efforts, is in our nation's school lunch programs around America, which are terrible. You know, we're feeding our kids like they're in the middle of a 7-Eleven. You know, you walk into some of these lunchrooms and there's like ho-hos and ding-dongs and cupcakes and soda and ice cream and chips and it's unbelievable. And so in this institution of learning where we're supposedly educating them in the classroom, shouldn't we also be educating them in the lunchroom? Because right now we're not. We're putting them on a path to illness. We're putting them on a path that's going to have them all develop diabetes, heart disease, and be dead by the time they're 60. You know, we have to change this. I mean, that's the one place where we really can have an influence, and I think we need to be focusing our efforts.
Well, Morgan, another country heard from. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Morgan Spurlock is producer, director, and guinea pig of the film Supersize Me. John Willoughby wears more hats than most food pros. He's executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. He's an award-winning food writer and co-author with his pal Chris Slazinger of a clutch of books on grilling and meat. John, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
John, what's your take on cheap cuts of lamb? What do you like?
Cheap cuts of lamb.
Yeah.
Well, I think the primary source for cheap cuts of lamb and my absolute favorite part of the lamb is the shoulder. It's much like the chuck in a beef in that it has more flavor than most other parts of the animal. It is a little tougher, of course, than the pricier cuts, but it does have that better flavor. And because lamb are brought to market so young, it is much more tender than you might think if you were comparing it to beef chuck.
Now, is that word going to be, because I don't see that word often on a package in the supermarket. Shoulder, I mean.
Well, you don't, because the cuts are not that popular. They've sort of gotten a bad reputation. But I think the more we start looking for them and buying them, the more they'll start appearing. For example, my personal favorite cut of lamb is the shoulder arm chop, which is a chop that costs about a quarter of what a loin chop will cost.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some fat and some bones in it, but it has got amazing lamb flavor. And because of the nature of the shoulder, you can grill it or you can braise it. So either of those two sort of opposite cooking methods works really well for it. And any chop you see, there are two main kinds of shoulder lamb chops. There's the blade chop and the arm chop.
Uh-huh.
But mostly they just label them shoulder chops, so you can't really be too sure which one you're getting. But they're both great, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. Shoulder chops are a wonderful deal in terms of what you pay for them, and they taste fantastic.
How do you like to prepare them?
Well, the shoulder chops, I basically grill. You can, as I said, you can braise them, but I really love them for the grill. And they can take a lot of strong flavors, too, because they've got that deep, rich lamb flavor. So you can use all kinds of, we like Greek preparations, Asian preparations. They can take almost any kind of strong flavors that you want to put on them.
Mm-hmm.
And another way to use the shoulder in addition to the chops is in kebabs. People usually think of having cut up lamb leg for kebabs, mm-hmm. but again, the shoulder has more flavor. And if you just buy a shoulder roast and cut it up yourself, you get an amazing value for the money and you get deeper and richer lamb flavor in your kebabs. And another option, and this is one that I really have come to love in the last week, and that is the shoulder roast. Again, you don't often see them, but if you ask a butcher for them, you can get them, and they are starting to appear in supermarkets. The boneless shoulder roast is the easiest to deal with. And they are, again, they are amenable to braising, moist cooking, but they're also tender enough to just roast. So they're very versatile. They are a little bit chewy compared to the leg, but they have, again, really great flavor. And we have been working in the test kitchens at Gourmet on perhaps my favorite recipe of the year so far, which is a roasted lamb shoulder in a spiced yogurt sauce with clarified butter.
Oh,
and you roast it for 3 or 4 hours in a little liquid, and then you put in this clarified butter for the last hour. You add a spiced yogurt sauce for the last about half hour, and you serve it with pine nuts and onions that have been cooked in that same clarified butter.
Oh,
it's like,
boy,
it's
that
falling
sounds good.
Off the bone. It's so rich. They've tested it maybe 6 times, and I think they have to test it 8 or 10 more to perfect it.
Yeah, you really want to get it right.
To make me happy.
Yeah.
It's an amazing flavor, and you can get that same kind of deep, rich flavor with many approaches to lamb shoulder. It's a really great cut.
I love the idea of the long cooking. You know,
yeah.
Any bargains to be had on the other end of the lamb? I mean, we're working the front end.
We're working the front end hard, but there are some cuts from the leg, and one in particular that are a good deal, and it's called a sirloin steak. And what it is from the blade, from the top end of the leg, they very often cut off 3 or 4 steaks about, half an inch or 3/4 inch thick
mm-hmm.
before they package the leg as a roast. And they're called sirloin steaks because they are exactly this equivalent of the sirloin in the cow. And these are, again, quite cheap, and they're even less fatty and they have less toughness than the shoulders. So if you can find the sirloin lamb steaks, they are an amazing bargain.
This is great. We can really save some money. Hey, John, thank you.
You're very welcome.
John Willoughby is author of Let the Flames Begin. You can get John's recipe for grilled lamb shoulder chops Greek style on the website, splendidtable.org. When a novelist makes a character instantly recognizable, you're witnessing craft. It becomes pure art when you, the reader, never notice it happening. Novelist Eleanor Lipman takes us behind the craft and the art to the table.
I write novels and I cook dinner, and some days the edges blur. Like me, my characters know their way around a kitchen, and like my family, they are good eaters. Increasingly, my plots thicken in restaurants as waiters hover, and increasingly readers ask, "What's with the food in your books?" My answer is, doesn't everyone characterize people by what they eat? Isn't it another descriptive tool like a story's furniture or its clothes? It seems so, well, easy. The dialogue balloon next to a character's plate, an arrow pointing to his or her true self. Let's say I want to sketch an ordinary Joe. Following the first law of writing fiction, showing rather than telling, I don't announce that Joe is unadventurous, prosaic, even dull, but I signal it by having him eat what? A. Sweetbreads on a bed of polenta. B. Orange ruffy. C. Ramps. D. Franks and beans. Try again. A man takes a seemingly appealing woman on a first date. He orders rotisserie chicken and garlic mashed potatoes, friendly, unpretentious, all-American, yet bistro chic. Over her bottled water, the woman can't decide what to have. She asks if the chef can make the risotto without butter or leave the gorgonzola out of the gorgonzola vinaigrette. The reader recognizes the woman to be A. on a diet, B. difficult. C, lactose intolerant. D, no fun. I began employing food as a narrative device when I was writing my first novel. In fleshing out one of my characters, I decided I needed a potluck contribution with airs, not a match with the other guests' four-grain bread and spiral-cut ham, and perhaps a dish not to anyone else's liking. It was 1988, so I chose calamari vinaigrette, ambitious, daunting, and I hoped, faintly ridiculous. This reliance on talking food may be rooted in a pivotal gastronomic experience in my own life. At 19, I was brought to a young man's parents' home for dinner, at which his mother served calf's liver, without onions, without apology, with so much serenity, in fact, that there was a cinematic otherworldliness to her composure. Did I need a degree in psychology to know my boyfriend's mother was A, opposed to her baby going steady, B, passive-aggressive, C, a few capers short of a canapé? Characters have to eat, don't they? Mine simply do it while you're watching. They make reservations, study menus, talk and cook, talk and eat, refill their wine glasses, linger over decaf. I'm at peace with this predilection because I find that every interaction with a stove, refrigerator, plate, and fork provides an opportunity to mine the telling detail, to make abstract notions concrete in a way I hope is both subtle and economic. Metaphors? Sort of. Blood, bones, lamb, variety meats, brains, guts, hearts are entrees with symbolic heft. But I found pleasure in telegraphing smaller coded messages. You know this person. You've dined with her or cooked for him. Happily, the supplies in this literary larder are limitless, and readers own the same ones. Tenderloin or tofu, coffee or herbal tea, iceberg or bib, man or mouse. Walk me through your checkout line and I'll tell you who you are.
Novelist Eleanor Lipman's latest book is The Pursuit of Alice Thrift. I envy novelists. They know what food writers learn the hard way. The adjective is your enemy. And once you say wonderful, you have nowhere to go. You have to make it happen on the page, not talk about it. I've got my personal list of heroes. Paul Bertoli is one. Paul is a chef in California who writes like a poet, but he never gives in to schmaltz. He writes about cooking by hand, and his prose captures that intimacy, that connection. He thinks onto the page, and he takes us with him. Paul's latest book is Cooking by Hand. Monique Trong's first novel is a stunner. It is The Book of Salt. Imagine picking your way through the mind of a man who has always been other, always an outsider. He's Vietnamese in the Paris of the 1920s. He's gay, and he's cooked to Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. Ruth Reichel, who heads up Gourmet magazine, is another favorite. Her autobiographical books, Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples, are keepers. And then there's the rancher writer Dan O'Brien, whose Buffalo for the Broken Heart hasn't left the bedside table for 2 years. So when you get tired of Tasty and lost in the mists of time, check out these books. They're on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what makes white eggs white and brown eggs brown? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Now, the question was, what makes white eggs white and brown eggs brown? It's earlobes. Well, and feathers. White chickens with white earlobes lay white eggs. Brown hens with brown earlobes lay brown eggs. Chickens have earlobes. I mean, who knew? The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Greg on the line from Louisville. Greg, what's happening? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question for you. Some friends and I decided that we had lived in Kentucky all of our lives, but we had never partaken in Kentucky tradition of the mint julep on Derby Day.
Ah.
So we went out to the store, we got a nice bottle of Kentucky bourbon, and we got some mint julep syrup, and we sat back to watch the Derby and took a sip of our mint julep and decided it was probably the most disgusting thing we ever drank in our lives. And so now I'm stuck with all these bottles of, well, I got two bottles of mint julep syrup, and barely any of them have been used. So I was hoping that maybe you would have a suggestion for something I might could do with this syrup rather than just pitch it.
What does the syrup taste like? I mean, it sounds like the syrup is the problem, not the bourbon.
Most likely. It is basically just a green sort of tasting, or green kind of thick mint syrup.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, you know, here's the thing. If it tastes awful, mm-hmm. I'd say the best thing you could do with it is pour it down the sink or bring it as a house gift to somebody you don't like very much.
Right.
I mean, if it tastes awful, it's like, I mean, I remember the day that we opened a bottle of wine and it was literally undrinkable.
Right.
And my husband turned to me and said, cook with it. And I said, that's fine. I have it, by the way, just in the defense of the mint julep. Now, I wasn't born and raised in Kentucky, but I'm a fan. And just if you were to try making it just with your own homemade sugar syrup, which
right.
is really easy. You know, it's equal sugar and water. Put it in a saucepan. Let it simmer until it's clear. Cool it, and you've got it. It'll keep in the fridge forever. But just do that with fresh mint and bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
It's killer. But
really?
Yeah, it really is good. I have a feeling that mint syrup is something that's awful and doctored. And what do the ingredients read like? I mean, is it just mint and sugar and water, or is there a lot
exactly,
of...
Exactly, yeah. You know, mint.
Look, if it tastes bad, you don't want to waste your palate on it or
Fair
the
enough.
Calories, okay? So, again, think about someone you don't like or dump it. Sell it at a garage sale.
There you go. Maybe take it back to the store and say, whatever it was you recommended to me was trash.
I think, yeah, get your money back and go out and buy some fresh mint and sugar.
Sounds good.
Hey, I wish I could have helped you with something terribly creative, but I think... You don't deserve bad food.
Well, thank you.
All right. Okay, Greg, take care.
You too. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us at 800-537-5252. All right. We have discovered a sure sign that the wine Prosecco has arrived. Now, we've been raving about this inexpensive sparkling wine from northern Italy for about 3 years. But I want you to know, now it has really come to the ultimate attention of the wine world, because the Riedel glass people, these are the people who design wine glasses to go with specific wines, have created a Prosecco glass. Now, the whole idea behind Riedel is that each glass is shaped differently for each wine, and it delivers the wine to the part of your palate where you'll taste the wine at its best. Now, I have only one gripe with this.
Prosecco sells for maybe between $10 and about $18 a bottle. Well, one Riedel glass for Prosecco is $28. Do the math. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Garrett is calling from Monterey Bay, California. Hey, Garrett, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Good morning, Lynn. Just want to say I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, and this is probably just a generic question a lot of people don't know the answer to, is what is a sous chef? What qualifies a sous chef? What's where'd the hierarchy come from? And all that kind of information.
You mean how is a restaurant kitchen organized?
Correct. And where did the term sous chef come from, and how was it applied? And
you're close to my heart. You're just digging into history here. This is the thing. Sous, S-O-U-S, means under.
Okay.
And a sous chef is usually second in command. There's usually the executive chef who oversees the entire kitchen, and the sous chef, at least in the classical sense, is the person who actually supervises hands-on cooking. And by the way, he or she may well also be cooking themselves.
Uh-huh.
And it started a very long time ago and it started in France. It's literally called the Brigade de Cuisine, meaning the brigade of the kitchen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's using an army term, a military term. And originally, going back to the medieval period, everybody who cooked and made a living at it was very carefully put into different categories by guilds. So, for instance, you might be a chef who made soup, and you would be a soupier or a soupière, and you could make soup and certain other things and market those, but you couldn't roast meat and sell that. That was a different area. That was the rôtisseurs. So, and then you had the pâtissier. This was the person who did the pastry, but the boulanger did the bread. And, you know, if you go to France today, you will often see bread sold separately from sweet things or pastries. So what happened was, eventually, with the advent of more and more eating out in restaurants, this was more or less after the French Revolution, so we're talking the end of the 18th century, the chef, or the chef de cuisine, meaning the chef of the kitchen, chef means head,
okay,
or whatever, he became the chef de cuisine, and under him were all those guild people, but now they were no longer involved in guilds. So he had a sous chef who was like his manager. He was the executive. Sous chef was the manager. And then you had what are called chef de partie. And each one of those, that was like saying they were department managers.
Oh, I see.
So one managed the roasting, one managed the baking, one managed the cold kitchen, you know, the salads and the aspics and all of that. And each one of those had a title. And then under them were called demi-chefs, like half-chefs. Those were the people who were actually doing the work. And under them, and these are terms you'll still find in France, were the commis, who were the apprentices. So the whole thing was this great, you know, you worked your way up that hierarchy.
Excellent answer.
So know that when you go into a really fancy restaurant with a large staff, they're operating back there like an army.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome. Thanks for a great question.
Bye-bye now.
Goodbye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. By the way, I got a letter. You may remember a couple of shows ago, I was talking about the toast rack, the British love of serving stone-cold toast on a toast rack, and that I thought it represented a psychosocial maladjustment in attitude toward food that existed in England. Well, I got a letter from Robert from Iowa, who has spent a good amount of time in England, and he said, you know, there may be another take on this, and he explained this. The British language is very exacting, and when the British say toast, all they mean is toasted bread. That term promises no more than toasted bread. He was in a hotel in London, a fancy hotel, and he was asked at breakfast if he wanted his toast American style, hot and buttered, or British style, which was on the toast rack and at room temperature. So he figured he'd go with the natives. He got the British style, and along with it came three butters from three different parts of England. When he asked the waiter, would he have gotten the butters with the hot toast, the waiter said no. He said, look, with hot toast, when you put butter on it, it could be margarine. But when you put butter
on cold toast, you can taste the butter. Robert said he tried it, and he was right. So I stand corrected. We've got Ann calling from Seattle. Hey, Ann, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about mortar and pestle. I heard you talking about it several weeks ago on the show, but I think I don't know how to use one.
Oh.
And I was making actually a chicken cacciatore recipe from your cookbook, which I love.
Oh, thank you.
And it called for a paste of rosemary, garlic, and salt.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe my definition, I don't know whether to use a round action, a pounding action, whether I don't have a big enough mortar and pestle, but I don't get a paste. I just get a lot of discrete pieces.
Well, I have to tell you, if you get a lot of discrete pieces and they cook into the chicken cacciatore, they're going to taste just great.
Yeah.
You know, so don't.
But they do, because I've made the recipe.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a good question because, you know, the whole idea of a mortar and pestle is that you have this sort of deep bowl and you have a pounder. You've got, you know, something that you can just beat things against the bottom of the bowl. And the technique, what I do is I kind of, I don't pound as much as I mash against the side of the bowl using a rotating action with my wrist. And I'm holding the pestle or pestle. I never remember how that's pronounced. But anyway, I'm holding it. I'm trying to think. I'm holding it the way I would hold a plunger.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I'm gripping it right around its handle, and I'm just kind of mashing things together. And in places where you may really want a paste, you could always add a little bit of water or oil.
Okay, which might help with it.
So, yeah, but for this recipe, you know, and I realize maybe I should have just said until it's broken up. And the reason why you do this, though, and this is the interesting part to me, is that when you mince or mash different ingredients together, I think you get a slightly different and more intense flavor than if you were to cut them all separately and then put them together.
Yeah, well, and that's what you had said, and I think that's true.
There's a reason, too, that's interesting, because if you've ever done, this takes us a little aside, but salt breaks down the garlic. And one of the things I've realized is if you, let's say you want to mash a clove of garlic. You don't want to use a garlic press. You want to use the side of your knife, or you want to do it in the mortar and pestle. What you do is you put a little salt on the board or in the mortar and pestle first, and then you start mashing the garlic into that. And the salt seems to actually help break it down. And I've actually used the side of my knife, and I keep, you know, sort of mashing it against the board. And by God, it turns to a paste.
Yeah.
So, you know, just as an FYI, that salt seems to really act on garlic. So anytime you want to get garlic really down to, you know, next to nothing, use some of the salt in a recipe and then mash into that.
Well, this is such a good recipe. This is the one with lots of browned peppers and onions. And
yeah, what could be bad? And you know, everybody thinks these recipes are so mysterious. Well, they're really not. But you know, you brown a lot of stuff and you really brown it well. It's got to taste good.
It tastes great.
It doesn't matter what it is. Hey, so, thank you, though.
All right. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Mortar and pestle. Most people don't think about this as a great kitchen gadget, but aside from being great to look at, I collect them, by the way. They are wonderful to work with. And they're in Mexico, you have these three-feeted ones. And I want to say they're called mojete. Please forgive me if I'm not saying this correctly, but it's out of a coarse stone. They work like a charm for any kind of pounding of spices, of garlic, of anything. And if you're going to buy one mortar and pestle sort of thing, get yourself to a Latin market and get your hands on one of these things, because they're fabulous. We stumbled upon another work of art this week. Tucker Shaw is a former advice columnist for Lovelorn Teens and author of a novel with recipes called Flavor of the Week. Well, he's been keeping a diary of sorts. Tucker joins us by phone. Tucker, welcome.
Thank you.
So what is this diary about?
What I wanted to do was keep a different kind of diary, since food is sort of the thing that drives me and gets me out of bed in the morning, and I, like a lot of people, live meal to meal. I figured that was the smartest thing for me to record.
So are you writing down everything that you eat?
What I do is I take a picture of everything that I eat, and then I record what time of day it was, where I was, and who I was with. A lot of times I'm by myself. But just looking at the photos on a personal level brings me exactly right back to the moment, and I remember what we were talking about and what else was going on that day. And it's a really nice way to remember what I was doing.
So how long have you been doing this? How many photos so far?
I've got about 700 photos. I started on the first of the year, on January 1st. I took a picture of cold pizza, and I wanted to go right through to the end of the year so that I had a complete record.
Has this changed the way you eat?
It hasn't changed what I eat or when I eat or where I eat. What it has changed is, I guess, I notice what I'm eating now in a way that I didn't before. Like, even just, you know, racing down the street in New York and scarfing down a bagel and cream cheese, now I'm forced by the project to take a moment and notice what I'm eating.
I'd imagine in a place like New York, the variety would be pretty striking.
It's out of control, and but in all good ways. And I suppose I had been guilty of becoming a little bit numb to exactly how much really is going on here. And taking the pictures has reminded me that, wow, you know, mango pavlova followed by lobster with a orange ginger foam is pretty unusual.
So what is a typical day of photos like?
A typical day, I probably take about 6 pictures, maybe 7, which immediately I noticed as challenging the sort of 3-meal-a-day myth that I had even about myself. And so a typical day will probably include some oatmeal, maybe a banana, and then who knows, maybe I'll have a falafel for lunch, and then for dinner, some fabulous exotic seafood risotto somewhere. Or perhaps I'll stay home and cook fried eggs and spinach.
So
what it's revealed to me is that even the mendacities of the patterns of my eating habits are somehow revealing in a way that makes me rethink what I thought I had been eating before.
It's such a thoughtful process, because when you have to take a picture, you really have to think about what it's about. What are you going to do with all this?
I don't know what I'm going to do with it all. What I'd most like to do, well, there are 2 things that I'd like to do. One is I'd like to bring other people on the bandwagon, because when I sit down at a plate of food and take out my camera and I'm forced to have a moment with what I'm about to eat, and also everyone else at the table is forced to have that moment, for me it's kind of fulfilling the same thing that saying grace probably did for my grandparents. They took a moment and they just appreciated or paid attention to what was happening. And I'd like to bring more people into that fold. Another thing I'd like to do is see all the pictures on a wall somewhere, because there's going to be 2,500 photos by the end of the year.
You can paper your living room. This is amazing.
It's pretty funny.
Oh, I hope you paper something that we can all see. Hey, Tucker, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Novelist Tucker Shaw is author of Flavor of the Week. He writes both advice and fiction for young adults. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought. At the end of a long, hard day, a young man's fancy turns to meat and potatoes. Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.